Do you recognize this voice?
Horses, 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 coming in all directions, white, shining, silver, studs with their nose in flames. He saw horses, horses.
That's Patti Smith, who's been called the godmother of punk. The intense hypnotic songs in her first album, Horses, created a new kind of music, a fusion of poetry and rock and roll. To hear that self-assured voice is a far cry from the Patti Smith of just a few years earlier, the South Jersey girl who dreamed of becoming an artist. It's the story she tells in her remarkable memoir, Just Kids.
In the spring of 1967, I assessed my life. I had dropped out of teacher's college, having not the discipline, the focus, nor the money I needed to continue. I was holding a temporary minimum wage job in a textbook factory in Philadelphia. My immediate concern was where to go next and what to do when I got there. I held to the hope that I was an artist. I knew I would never be able to afford to go to art school and had to make a living. My few comrades had moved to New York City to write poetry and study art, and I felt very much alone.
Patti Smith went off to New York with little more than a dream. She met another young aspiring artist, Robert Mapplethorpe, who would later become famous for his revolutionary style of photography. They became lovers, and both would eventually explode onto the New York art scene. Steve Paulson sat down with Patti Smith to talk about those early years.
You write about how you always longed to enter the fraternity of the artist, even when you were very young. Why did art have so much allure for you?
It just was the most familiar thing to me. You know, the thing that I was most attracted to as a child, even a toddler, was the book. I loved to read. When I saw art for the first time in person at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, I wanted to commit it. It seemed totally familiar to me.
And clearly, growing up where you did was not the best environment to pursue an artistic career. So you boarded a bus to New York City. You had no money, no job prospects, no place to stay. What were you looking for?
Freedom, a job. I mean, in New York City, I didn't have to worry about how I was dressed, if I was offending anybody just by, you know, not teasing my hair or wearing the right clothes. You know, you could go to New York City and nobody cared. They didn't care how you looked, or as long as you didn't bother anybody, you could do what you wanted.
But this must have been tough, especially those first weeks you were there. I mean, you were sleeping on the streets, scrounging for food. How long did it take for you to feel grounded, to feel like you belonged there?
Well, I guess I most felt grounded when Robert and I got our own place, which, you know, it was only a couple of months. I came from a lower middle class family. We were no strangers to being hungry or strife. My father was on strike a lot. My mother worked really hard. She did ironing. She was a waitress. She had four children. So it wasn't like such a big deal to me.
How did you meet Robert Mapplethorpe?
I met him in Brooklyn near Pratt. I had some friends who lived at Pratt, and I thought maybe they could give me a helping hand, maybe give me a place to stay the night. And I went to their address, but they had left. And the new fella that lived there said, well, go and ask the boy, my roommate, he might know. And I opened a door and found the boy sleeping. And when I walked in, I looked down at him and he woke up and smiled at me. And that's how I met Robert.
The way you tell the story, it's remarkable how quickly you two connected. It seems like you recognized almost immediately that you were kindred spirits.
Yes, we were very two of a kind, both in appearance and desire and the fact that neither one of us had anything. Robert didn't have his own place to live. He had left the ROTC and therefore lost his scholarship at the art school. He was trying to figure his life out. You know, both of us were, you know, at this pivotal point in our young lives, both of us 20 years old. We just, I don't know, we just recognized one another. The city was a real city, shifty and sexual. I was lightly jostled by small herds of flushed young sailors looking for action on 42nd Street, with its rows of X-rated movie houses, brassy women, glittering souvenir shops, and hot dog vendors. I walked for hours from park to park. In Washington Square, one could still feel the character of Henry James and the presence of the author himself. Entering the perimeter of the White Arch, one was greeted by the sounds of bongos and acoustic guitars, protest singers, political arguments, activists leafleting, older chess players challenged by the young. The open atmosphere was something I had not experienced. Simple freedom that did not seem to be oppressive to anyone.
You ended up sharing an apartment with Robert, which also became a kind of art studio for the two of you. Did you see yourselves as artists back then? I mean, back when you were 20 years old?
Well, Robert certainly did. Robert was completely formed as an artist. He continued to evolve, but he had a full concept of himself as an artist. I was still on the tightrope, you know, thinking of myself more as an apprentice, but he instilled a lot of confidence in me. But we worked all the time. I mean, we had nothing. We had no TV, no telephone. I mean, basically, we had an old record player and a handful of records and our books and each other.
What do you think Robert was looking for in art?
Oh, absolutely something that hadn't been seen before. So Robert was always striving to open up new territory.
What about you?
I have a different, I guess I'm a more literary worker. I just want to do things that I think are good. I didn't have the same ambition to rip the seams of the art world. I just wanted to do things that I thought were aesthetically fine. In my low periods, I wondered what was the point of creating art. For whom? Are we animating God? Are we talking to ourselves? And what was the ultimate goal? To have one's work caged in art's great zoos, the Modern, the Met, the Louvre? I craved honesty, yet found dishonesty in myself. Why commit to art? For self-realization or for itself? It seemed indulgent to add to the glut unless one offered illumination. Often I'd sit and try to write or draw, but all of the manic activity in the streets coupled with the Vietnam War made my efforts seem meaningless. I could not identify with political movements, and trying to join them I felt overwhelmed by yet another form of bureaucracy. I wondered if anything I did mattered. Robert had little patience with these little introspective bouts of mine. He never seemed to question his artistic drives, and by his example, I understood that what matters is the work, the string of words propelled by God becoming a poem, the wave and weave of color and graphite scrawled upon the sheet that magnifies his motion, to achieve within the work a perfect balance of faith and execution. From this state of mind comes a light, life-charged.
You and Robert Mapplethorpe moved to the Chelsea Hotel, which was famous for the bohemian artists and eccentric characters who either lived there or passed through. William Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg, Diane Arbus, Janis Joplin. I had the sense that that was the perfect place for you at that point in your life.
I think the Chelsea Hotel was indeed the perfect place for Robert and I because we had no money. We didn't belong to any specific community. We were entirely both dependent on each other, but independent of anyone else. And I think that the Chelsea offered us shelter, an instant community, and a plethora of mentors. I mean, for me especially, I mean, I got to know Gregory Corso and William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg there. We met people from the arts, people who were both struggling and people who had some success. The community at the Chelsea was not broken down by things like celebrity. If you had a little more money, you had a bigger room.
Now, there are a few artists who kind of loom over your memoir. One is Andy Warhol. And you say that Robert Mapplethorpe became fixated on trying to meet him and to be recognized by him. Why did Andy Warhol have such allure at that time in New York?
Well, Andy Warhol was like the king of New York. He had the mantle after Marcel Duchamp. Robert recognized many things about the modern world in terms of art, the high society aspects of art, you know, the responsibility to do not only great work, but to do something new. And Warhol, as Duchamp, had done that.
Now, this was a period of tremendous personal transformation, and it was certainly true for Robert as well. He came to realize that he was primarily attracted to men, and of course he became famous later for his homoerotic photographs. That must have been hard for you to realize that his interests primarily lay elsewhere.
Well, yeah. You know, he was my boyfriend, and it was hard for him too, though. We loved each other. We really cared about each other. And Robert's nature drew him away, but it didn't lessen his love for me. We didn't have a fight. We had to weather that together because our bond was much deeper than one's sexual persuasion.
The wall is high, the black bond, the baby, my arms in a swaddling clothes and under the sun. The sky will split and the planets will shift.
During this time, you were also writing poetry, and there came a point where you started performing poetry up on stage, and then you were accompanied by music. Was this a natural progression for you to get up there in front of people and to perform what you had written?
Well, I don't know if it was natural, but it evolved honestly. I think what made it a speedier process, considering I had no particular ambition, is that I'm very comfortable getting up in front of people. I wouldn't say that I'm an exhibitionist, so the stage, you know, is not a foreign place to me. I just had to figure out what I was going to do on it.
Of course, you eventually became famous for fusing poetry with rock and roll. Did you see yourself as a musician back then in your early days?
No.
So that was something really new for you.
Well, I never considered myself a musician. I can hardly play an instrument. I mean, I can play really good feedback, but I only know a handful of chords. I can improvise on piano, and I can improvise on clarinet. I play by ear, but I would hardly call myself a musician.
You certainly have done very well fronting a rock band if you aren't
a musician. Well, I consider myself a performer, so I know that I can do that.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milton, pot of thieves, wild cord on my sleeve. Thick, heart of stone, my sins my own, they belong to me.
Now, over the years, you and Robert Mapplethorpe went on to lead your separate lives. You married and moved to Detroit. You always remained close. And when you heard that Robert was dying of AIDS in the late 80s, you went back to New York and visited him. And you have an extraordinarily moving passage near the end of your book describing that visit. Could you read that?
In mid-February, driven by a sense of urgency, Fred and I flew to New York, and I went to see Robert by myself. It seemed so quiet. I realized it was the absence of his terrible cough. I lingered by his empty wheelchair. Lynn Davis's image of an iceberg rising like a torso turned by nature dominated the wall. He had a white cat, a white snake, and there was a brochure of white stereo systems lying on his white table that he had designed. I noticed he had added a white square in the blackness surrounding his image of a sleeping Cupid. There was no one present save his nurse, and she left us to ourselves. I stood by his bed and took his hand. We stayed like that for a long time, not saying anything. Suddenly he looked up and said, "Patty, did Art get us?" I looked away, not really wanting to think about it. I don't know, Robert. I don't know.
Patti Smith, reading from her memoir, Just Kids. She spoke with Steve Paulson.